Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Welcome to a world made by plants. You know, I'm thinking more and more about that. It's like, I better figure these plant guys out because, boy, they're making the world I live in. I don't think I have any special affection for plants over, say, snakes or dogs or, you know, that kind of stuff. It's just that I realize, man, if you're going to figure this world out, you got to know the plants. You got to figure the plants out first. And so, yeah, you know, you get to know them a little better. You like them a little better. And you like them more and more as time goes on because you realize, boy, they've made the world I live in. That's what we do here. That's one of the reasons we talk a lot about plants on this show, I admit. We talk about other things. Give me a call. We can talk about all of that. Hey, listen, there is several things I want to follow up on. The first is it, who's got the picture of the maple? Let me, Brian, Brian, sent me, Brian, I think we've clarified that, Brian, don't mess with him. Don't mess with him. Do not mess with those river birch. They're going to be kind of narrow. They're not going to have a big broad crown. That's just a river birch. You can't really change that. If you try to change that, you're going to make a mess. They're going to have a narrow crown. That's one of their virtues. They have some downsides too, but their virtue is they actually have a narrow crown. That can make them very useful in some places. Don't mess with it. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. But Brian also sent me a picture of a maple, and it's one of the Asian maples. It's very nice looking. It looks really good around his patio. So he wants to know how to prune it. Brian, here's what I think I would do. You know, it is looking a little bit thick. Because you want to live around it and work around it, you want it to be a little more open. The first thing I would do is those, some of the side branches that are lower down have already become kind of aggressive. They're already pretty big. I wouldn't cut them all the way to the base. But I would begin trimming those side branches close that are down low. Each year, prune those side branches back by half. Or maybe cut them back by half twice this year. That's fine. Cut them back once this spring by half. Cut them back again by half this fall, early in fall, say September, early around 1st of October. And get those back, and then by next spring, it may be okay if the tree has grown enough. It may be okay to cut them all the way back to the base, or you may need to cut them back by half again in the spring just to get them down, and then maybe next fall it'll be okay to cut those back to the base. But those low branches are going to make it difficult for you to work around it. And by low branches, I would say on your patio, I think you really want to get some of that branching, some of that low branching down waist high and between waist and chest high, you really want to reduce that because it's going to make it very hard to be around. You can thin that tree if you like. I wouldn't top it. Do not top. It's a bad thing to top. It's almost never a good thing to top a tree. It's not even a good thing to top a crepe myrtle, but crepe myrtles have survived everything except for the fact that we planted them everywhere, and they're not going to survive that. But don't top the tree. You can thin the tree. You thin some branches out. That's just a general rule that that all arborists believe in and talk about. Topping can be a big problem for trees. And it can create some problems that you'll have to deal with later on. Let's don't top it. Just thin that tree and get some of those lower branches out. it's nice on a tree like that. You can have lots of different stems going different directions. But we'll want to talk about thinning. Right now, we're going to need to talk about you're getting some of those lower limbs cut back. If you don't understand what I'm saying, Brian, about that, you just give me a call. We'll talk about it a little bit more as the morning goes on, and I'll give specific directions about how to do that. Now, Rusty over in Moss Point, Rusty, I keep looking at this trunk. You know, with a deeply fissured, Rusty's asking me what kind of trees he's got in his swamp. He sent me a couple of pictures. You can do that kind of crazy thing, too. All you got to do is take a picture of it and send me that picture. And 343-0106, that's all it is. Just text it to me, and we can take a look at it. And if it's in focus, a lot of times I can actually tell you what we're looking at. And pictures are getting more and more in focus because cameras are getting smarter than we are, apparently. Rusty, the first tree you showed me, the picture up top with the smooth bark, is definitely Tupelo, and probably Nyssa aquatica, the swamp Tupelo. Great tree, wonderful tree. Makes good honey, by the way. David Preston, are you listening? Good honey from Tupelo's. Tupelo honey, you remember that? All of them make good honey. That's swamp Tupelo. The other one with the really deeply fissured bark is going to be one of two things, and I'll have to, you know, I need to see a little bit more. It's an unusually large specimen of either one, if I'm right. It's either going to be a sourwood, which is a really wonderful tree, Oxydendron arboreum, a member of the, it's related, kind of related to azaleas and blueberries of all things. Isn't that weird? It's over in that part of the genus, family, of plants, and, Oxydendron arboreum, sourwood, which is a wonderful tree, or it's going to be sassafras. And I can't quite tell which. From the perspective, I think that's going to be one of those two. Find me a leaf. Help me out. Find me a leaf. Look around the tree. See if you can find some old leaves or if you can see any new leaves sprouting. But see if you can find some of the old leaves. Either one of those is going to have a very distinctive leaf, and I'll be able to tell pretty quickly. So there goes. Rusty, help me out on that one. But I think it's either a sourwood or a sassafras. Both of them are pretty cool things to have. Right. So that's a good one. That's a very good one. Got a couple callers. I'm listening. Who's our first caller up? Is it Colleen?
Colleen's on from Fairhope, I think.
Colleen, I'm listening. What's up?
Hi. I wanted to ask you a question about my Meyer lemon. I don't know what happened to it, but most of the branches just died. And I have one branch that comes up, and it did bear some smaller fruit. But I don't know whether I should cut off all the rest and leave that one there, or what should I do with it?
Okay, tell me when the branches died. Was it 2 years ago?
Yes.
Yep. So we had a very hard winter 2 years ago, and Meyer's lemons tend to die back in very hard winters. But, now, Colleen, listen to me carefully, because this is a little confusing.
Okay.
If your Meyer's lemon is grafted, if it is grafted, what comes back may not be Meyer's lemon anymore. If it's not grafted, and a lot of Meyer's lemons are not grafted, what comes back is a Meyer's lemon. And within a couple or 3 years, you're going to have lots of fruit. The fruit that developed last year, did it look like a classic Meyer's lemon fruit?
It did, but it wasn't near as large as they were previously.
Yeah, Well, that can mean a lot of things. It was it perfectly round? Did it have a, was it kind of a round lemon looking thing?
Yes.
Yeah. So it was a Meyer's lemon, and I think you're not grafted. The one thing you can do is look down towards the base of that plant, and right around the base, there'll be a little knot about 3 to 6 inches from the ground. A little knot, you'll see it where it looks like two things are welded together, and it makes a little knot right there. If you see that knot, that means your plant's grafted. And if as long as the branches are coming from above the knot, you're okay. If you don't see a knot, you're really okay.
Oh, okay.
So you hope there's not a knot, and if there's not a knot, then you're going to be just fine. And it's coming from above the graft, And it's going to be a good Meyer's lemon. It just takes a little while for them to recover from a bad freeze like we had two winters ago. And it should do that really well this year. Give it a little cottonseed meal. Just sprinkle that around on the ground, mm-hmm. around the tree, to get it growing good this year. And you may have, depending on how big it is, you may have a lot of fruit this year. You may have to wait a couple of years. You may have to wait one more year before you get a whole lot more fruit. But it'll recover.
So if it's not a knot, then I don't need to cut anything back. So I really shouldn't cut anything back, no matter what.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes,
listen, if you...
I got this in a pot from Orange Beach.
You have it in a pot?
And it was... transplanted into the yard.
Transplanted in a pot. Take a picture of it, Colleen. Take a picture right around the base and try to send it to me. Text it to me before the show's over, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right. Oh, good music. I don't want to talk through it.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Lots of things to talk about. Sarah, I'm interested in policies about wildflowers. It's a great question. Sorry you had to drop off, but if you get a chance, call back. Love to talk about that. Josh, let's talk about your citrus, your Meyer's lemon. It looks grafted, Josh. It looks very much like it's a grafted Meyer's lemon. So probably keeping it in a container is the way to go. And you've got a pretty nice going container going there. I think I would, in spite of the fact that it's going to be a little bit of a pain during cold spells, it'll have some other advantages. I would keep that one in a container because it does appear to me to be grafted. And so it's not going to do as well in the ground. The one thing, if you have a grafted tree and you don't want it to be grafted, one of the crazy things you can do is, this is tricky. If you plant it in the ground and it's grafted, you can build the soil level up gently, and it may root out into that soil eventually. But it's tricky. It's hard. I probably shouldn't have even said that out loud. I'm going to take it back. It's a trick that can work, but it can be hard to do. It can be hard to do. Somebody sent me a picture of daylilies. They have the classic daylily rust, which is such a problem, which makes daylilies a problem, frankly. Some varieties are more susceptible to it than others, but boy, that rust can really get to the daylilies. It is very hard to live with the rust. Very hard to deal with it in our climate. Some varieties are more susceptible than others, but that's a daylily rust. There's not a really great way to deal with it. It's going to be a real problem, however, because when the foliage overwinters like this, let's talk about that daylily rust. I'm going to do a little research to see if anything new has developed in terms of daylily rust. It's one of the reasons why you don't see daylilies as much anymore, because they're a little bit more of a pain to manage because of some of the diseases we bring in. You know, it's one of those things where plants get really popular and then they create ideal conditions for the diseases. Somebody brings in a disease, boom, it's everywhere. It's a word of warning, folks. Chris in Pace, what that bush is a flowering quince, and the fruits that are forming are quince, and a lot of times those quince fruits are quite edible. They make quince jelly out of them. Flowering quince, the fruits are indeed edible. You'll have to look up some recipes for quince. Kynomeles is the species. flowering quince is what it is. Boy, am I catching up on everybody. Since got a great picture of a live oak, a 20-year-old live oak. What a great testament to how quickly live oaks grow here. I mean, we think of them as very slow, but this is well documented. Little stick when he planted it 20 years ago. It is now a big tree. And I think most people would say, oh gosh, that must be 50 years old. And it's not. It's just everything grows fast here. It's one of those issues. If you're having a problem growing your tree fast, well, let's talk about it, because there's something wrong. There's something wrong if it ain't growing fast. Hey, Bruce. Oh boy, let's talk about those daylilies. Bruce, you there?
No, he's gone, Bill.
Okay. Bruce, I'm sorry I missed you. So Danny's sent me a picture of a little vine that looks like a potato in the ground. That is a smilax, Danny. Smilax. It's one of the really cool plants of the Gulf Coast and of Alabama. I really love smilax. You know, that looks like my favorite smilax, which has thorns only at the base of the plant. It's only thorny at the base of the plant, if I'm not mistaken, as the top of the plant doesn't have thorns on it at all. And that actually is used as a decorative vine in a lot of places. It's in fact throughout the South. that's Johnson Jackson vine, it's sometimes called. It's really delicious to eat. The tips of Jackson vine are just absolute. I eat them in spring. They're wonderful. They're really great. They make great wreaths. You can make a great wreath out of them. And I have so many uses for Jackson vine that actually I don't have it much as a weed anymore in my yard, because I keep cutting the vines back, and they never seem to produce as much vine as I would like. So if you can't find a use for it, how do you get rid of Jackson vine? You take the tips of the vines this time of year and get you a little milk jug. Put a little bit of Roundup in there, just a little bit of Roundup, mix it with a little bit of water, run the tips of that vine into the milk jug. It will have an impact, particularly this time of year. It's less effective later in the year, but very much this time of year, it can make a big difference. It can make a big difference. But think about using them first. They're really beautiful. Make beautiful vines. If you have any questions about how to eat them, or how to make vines out of them, or how to make pretty decorative growing vines out of them, let me know, and we'll figure it out. Taxman weighs in on daylily rust. It's a total disaster. You know, I don't know. It's tough. I've not talked about daylily rust in a while, because I think most people gave up on daylilies. A lot of folks just gave up on them because of daylily rust. Some varieties are resistant, and that's probably the best way to deal with it. But I'll do what I can. Kelly, I'm listening. What's up, Kelly? You there?
Years ago, back in the 50s, actually, I was in a biology class in college, and our instructor, we were talking navel oranges, and at that time, we were told that all navel oranges were generated from a gene mutation or something, where the tree started to make a fruit, and then for some reason that fruit failed to develop, and then what followed on that same blossom was the navel orange, and it was a big, huge orange that we think it was in Florida, and the schools sold those oranges as a project for several years, and the quality of that orange got so poor you could barely Vallisellum. Now, you could get a blood orange out of California, and it has a navel characteristic to it. And I'm looking at some relatively small oranges that are labeled navel oranges. And I just wondered what happened to that. We had assumed back in the 50s that all navel oranges came from that one tree that had that mutation on it. And obviously, you know, geneticists or whoever have engineered some derivative of that. And I wondered what your opinion or knowledge of it was.
Well, several things, you're describing several things going on. And so the first off is, if you're seeing navel oranges of different sizes, that's very typical of the difference between Florida and California growing conditions. A lot of fruits that get fairly large in Florida stay fairly small in California because of the dry conditions. And in general, California, same citrus grown in California and Florida is going to look different and taste completely different. That's very characteristic. And some of the differences in taste that you may be seeing may be the difference between navel oranges grown in Florida and navel oranges grown in California. That's one guess. I will also tell you that as certain plants are passed along, they change. It's almost like the code that sort of gets passed on, gets distorted a little bit each time you pass it along. And so sometimes the pass-along plants lose their quality. There's also viruses and other things that begin to affect fruit over time and that get into fruit stocks, and sometimes they have to try to eliminate the virus, and that changes the fruit stock just a little bit. And sometimes the virus itself changes. These are all really interesting questions. And now I didn't get to answer it all, but we're going to come right back and I'm going to talk about it just a little more when I come back.
Me and my best friend Lillian in her blue tick and all get in. Sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played. Waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red dirt.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back to Gulf Coast Sunday Morning with Plain Gardening. You know, I'm just going to take this little opportunity to remind people why I say that fall is the best time to plant most everything, and that's because we do get these little droughts in April and May coming up. And you can get beyond the droughts. You just got to be super vigilant about watering. And so Colleen is asking me, is it okay to plant a maple now and a Japanese maple? Yes, it's okay. It's fine. It's great. But you got to be really vigilant about watering in spring because we get these little droughts. Right now, as David Preston's reminding me, we are in the first stage of drought. It's amazing, isn't it? Absolutely amazing, because it just seemed very wet in February. But it wasn't really that wet. It was just wet. It wasn't rainy wet. And so we didn't get a lot of moisture, and things are beginning to dry out a little bit. And in April and May, they'll dry out even more. So let's hope we get a little bit more rain coming in, maybe this weekend, and it'll help us a little bit more. But you got to be vigilant about watering. Colleen, go ahead and plant that maple now if you want. Listen, let's go back to talk about fruits because it is an interesting question. Navel oranges, navel oranges aren't the best oranges for us for a lot of different reasons. And they're not as well adapted to this part of the Gulf Coast. They're going to have a very different flavor than they would have in areas where they're grown ideally, in part because they don't have that long winter period to ripen. a lot of navel oranges were traditionally sold in starting really in January, February, March, like grapefruit, and they continue to develop flavor over if it's a cool winter. This past winter would have been fine for navel oranges in Mobile because it was very mild, but most winters aren't like that. And most people pick their navel oranges before time. So Hamlin oranges are the oranges for us. I don't know that Hamlin is a particularly good orange farther south, because it probably doesn't get cool enough early enough to have a really good Hamlin. So Hamlin is a great orange for us. And that's what I'm saying about navel oranges. It depends a lot on where you grow them. And the flavor is going to change dramatically from place to place because of the temperatures that vary from place to place, because of soils that vary, because of rainfall patterns that vary. It's just part of that whole thing. And you know, it's why what I say, can I digress only slightly to say tomatoes. And so somebody, you read about somebody up in Minnesota or Ohio or wherever, Virginia, and they say, oh, we got this great tomato. It tastes so good. And you get that tomato, and it's some heirloom tomato, and you bring this heirloom tomato down to Mobile, and you plant it in Mobile, and you get one tomato out of it because it takes too long to grow, and the bugs eat most of the rest of them. But you get one tomato, and you taste it, and you say, well, I got one tomato. And you taste it, and you say, this isn't all that good. They don't know what they're talking about. Well, they do. But plants are very much about the places they're developed. And you have to think about it very carefully. We do satsumas better than any place else. You try to grow our satsumas, you try to do the satsumas that we grow here and that grow in southern Japan, any place else, you try to grow them in California, they lack the flavor. You try to grow them in South Florida, oh, they're terrible. Terrible. Because there's a temperature, and have I said enough? Am I making sense about the navel thing? There are some other issues with navels as well, and some virus issues. This leads me back to a question from who had the question about the improved Meyer's lemon. A lot of people ask me, what is improved Meyer's lemon? Improved Meyer's lemon is pretty simple. It's a Meyer's lemon that has had the virus. There is a virus that is attached to the seed material or to the propagation material. Improved Meyer's lemon has had that virus removed. I can't tell much difference between them, even in terms of virus susceptibility and in terms of growth. But that's basically the only difference. That's the biggest difference. I don't think there's a lot of difference in taste or anything else. But it's had a virus that has gotten into the genetics. It's had that virus removed. When you see improved Meyer's lemon, that's what that means. So there we go. Are we good? Taxman is asking me, there are two dogwoods blooming on the eastern shore. Can seed be disease resistant? I may try to gather and plant seed. There's always that hope that we're going to come up with a disease-resistant dogwoods. But here's the problem, and just this is the problem you got to look at with dogwoods. There is more than one disease that attacks dogwood along the Gulf Coast. It is a complex of diseases, and it is going to be very and pests, and it is going to be very unlikely that you're going to find a dogwood that deals well with all of them. There have been a lot of attempts to find dogwoods that are resistant, and boy, they just really, in the end, they prove not to be all that resistant. And they may survive for a few years, but then you get dogwood borers and other things that begin to affect them, the powdery mildews that affect them really badly. Not alternaria. Maybe it is an alternaria, some type of... There's several leaf diseases, dogwood anthracnose, and other diseases that affect them. And they're all here. They're all here. And then people say, oh, well, this Cornell created a dogwood that's disease resistant. Well, that's resistant to the disease that affects dogwoods at the northern end of their range, not the diseases that affect the dogwoods at the southern end of their range. Taxman, give it a try. I'm not hopeful. It's not good. But you know, you go up to Evergreen, go up to north of Evergreen and north, and the dogwoods are just beautiful. Even around Citronelle, I mean, I think they're okay. It's just that these hot nights create ideal conditions for diseases that dogwoods don't deal well with. And I think that's part of the problem is dogwoods just really ultimately don't like it that much on the Gulf Coast. Nights are too hot. Nights stay too warm. Winters are too short. It's too humid. Everything is perfect for the diseases. There it is. But give it a shot. I hate to be too discouraging about that. Somebody sent me a picture of a citrus. I'm going to have to figure that out as to what's going on. Because that picture kind of worries me a little bit. But I think there's several explanations for what I'm seeing, none of which are total disasters, but I'll take a look at that. Hey, anybody's got any questions? Shoot them our way. 251-343-0106. 251-343-0106. I'm looking through here trying to see if I have done justice to everybody's questions. You know, the daylily rust thing, it really, really bothers me that I can't give you a good, simple fix for that. I'll tell you, if you move north from the coast, once again, in North Alabama, daylily rust is a little bit of a problem. Central Alabama, it's a little bit of a problem. But you know, the daylilies still do fine. And most of them have deal with that fine. They might get rust late in the season, but it doesn't bother anybody. For us, the rust starts very early on, and it makes it very difficult. And it's just that, you know, people say, oh, well, plants don't like the heat down here along the Gulf Coast. And it's not so much that it's hotter here during the day. It's not. It's the fact that it's warmer during the night. And that causes problems for plants, some types of plants that are from northern climates. Those warm nights can make it hard for them to breathe properly, and daylilies are one of those plants. A lot of daylilies are from more northern areas. It can make them harder for them to breathe properly, to balance photosynthesis with respiration. Respiration takes over, photosynthesis declines. It's a messy issue. And that makes them more susceptible to diseases. And then on top of that, the warm nights and the constant humidity make certain diseases more prominent. And so, boom, there you go. Some of those plants, like daylilies, that are very popular north of Birmingham in the central part of the country, don't do so well when they're moved south. Dogwoods, daylilies, that's just the problem. Now, does that mean it's bad to live in Mobile? Well, if you want to grow daylilies in dogwoods, it's probably not the place for you. if you must have both of those things, you're going to have a tough time in Mobile. I can just tell you, because you can have to struggle with a lot of varieties of them. But on the other hand, think of all the things we can do. Think about the camellias. Think about the satsumas. Think about the Hamlin oranges, the other wonderful things we can do really, really well that we would miss. So there's more than enough compensation, for all that. Hey, we got a couple of callers. Let's try to get to one before we have to take a break. Dan, what's up?
Bill. Hey, Mr. Bill.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to call and follow up with you about the tomatoes, where I kind of got the little white spot from the sunburn. You were saying that some of those are kind of small. I've been meaning to actually ask you about that. Are they too small to maybe get in the ground and get in a pot and start from like right now? Because I've got a couple. I sent you another picture where I've got some of the some tomatoes I've got in bigger pots. And there's this this one cherry tomato, just for an example, kind of right there in the front. And it got to the size it's at now. It's about maybe seven inches tall, maybe like 6-7 inches wide. It went from some of the smaller ones I have to that size in a really short period of time? And they grow pretty fast, right?
Some of the smaller ones do, yeah. So, yeah, so it's a beautiful collection of tomatoes you've got there. And the bigger ones, you know, the bigger ones are plenty big to put in the ground. Maybe even, you know, they should have gone in the ground just a little while ago. Some of the smaller ones look like they're a little bit smaller. But, you know, if you put those small ones in the ground, you'll be okay as long as they're hardened off. And I don't think it's a bad thing to put them in the ground. The one thing I would do, in fact, I think that there's an advantage to go ahead and putting those smaller ones in the ground now rather than continuing to grow them in pots. The one thing I would do is give them a little bit of protection from the wind and really, really treat them really nice. They're gonna sit there in the ground for about, 5 days, and then they're going to start growing, and you're going to be fine. So the short of it is, at this point, it's nicer to have bigger plants to put in the ground. The smaller plants are going to be a little, it's almost like they don't have enough meat on their bones to really produce enough heat to fend off cold and they're probably more light sensitive and everything. But you're okay.
Right.
Right now, the big thing is put them in the ground, protect them from wind. That's the big one right now. Protect them from wind. And if you think the sun is too intense in the middle of the day, you can actually just put a few little branches with leaves, just scatter them around it so that they get a little dappled sun. And that's one little trick I do when I haven't hardened off plants correctly. I protect them a little more and then put a little bit of break some branches with some leaves on them, and just so that they get, I can get a little bit of dapple. I poke them in the ground so they get a little bit of dapple shade, if you see what I'm saying, around that plant until they can adjust. And it doesn't take long, 2 or 3 or 4 days, they'll be ready to go. But I'd say go ahead and plant them.
Okay. And you see some of the containers I've got some of these others in. Those are, I got like 4-gallon containers, and I've got these big ones that used to be the cow feed. Are those all going to be kind of at least halfway big enough to grow some of these cherry tomatoes in?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think they will. I think they will. Hey.
All right, Mr. Bill. Yeah. I appreciate your help. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Dan.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. Welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Let's do this fast because we don't have much time, but we got a lot of things to do. Colleen did just exactly what I asked her to do. Thank you, Colleen. She sent me pictures of her plant. It is not grafted, Colleen. It is definitely not grafted. So take out that dead wood, the stuff that's obviously dead. Just saw it off the best you can. Doesn't matter, except that it's ugly. And just kind of cut it all out, and it'll be in the way later. Just cut that out and let this new growth come on out. It's taken it a while to recover. I'm not sure I can explain that unless it's shady conditions and difficult conditions there. You know, it's why Meyer's lemons are what they are for the Gulf Coast. Yeah, every now and then they'll get killed back, but they're, boom, just give them a couple of years. They'll be back producing really, really well. And it looks like yours is not grafted, Colleen. That's a very good thing. And so you're going to be just fine. Johnny, can I identify that tree for you? I can, Johnny, if you'll take some leaves. Take some of the older leaves that have gotten a little bit shiny, a little bit more mature, a little bit harder and shiny. Take those leaves, crush them in your hand, and smell them. They're going to smell kind of vanilla, but like vanilla. They're going to smell like they're going to smell like black cherry. They're going to smell like cyanide, which is actually what you're smelling. Which you smell in all fruits like peaches and pears and cherries. That is black cherry. That is our native black cherry. It's a tree. Whatever it's growing up in, it will grow up. It will become a tree, but that's our native black cherry. That's what that is. Do Pachysandra terminalis work well here? Somebody must be selling Pachysandra a lot. Excuse my sneeze. But because I'm seeing it more, it is my thought that it doesn't do that well here. I don't think it's going to do that well. But people are trying it more for some reason. Somebody's selling it more. Just be careful. I wouldn't plant a lot of it. I'd experiment with it because I don't think it's going to do really, really well. Hey, who do we have on the line, Charlie? Have we got a couple of callers on the line?
Yeah, let's go to Tara first.
Tara, I'm listening. What's up?
Good morning. First of all, the tomato thing, I've done that back and forth. Started with containers, and Brandywine, which is an heirloom tomato, one tomato, and it was the most delicious tomato I've ever tasted. But, you know, now you can buy such great canned tomatoes. The fire-roasted things particularly, they're higher in nutrition, they're certainly higher in ease, and they're probably actually even cheaper. So I grow more peppers now. Peppers are my pet, you know. I have one that, and it did water root. A piece of it broke off, and I stuck it in some water, and I got a couple of different plants coming off of it. It's one of the Caribbean types, I think. I don't know.
Yeah,
it does seem to be a total habanero, but it is quite, it'll get the job done. But it's not too hot to enjoy, and it's very fruity, peppers just don't take up as much time and space and energy if you got to move something around in containers. My question to you, Mr. Bill, is basil, what is your current favorite? Because I love them too.
The current favorite basil is the basil that doesn't die from powdery mildew. And I'm experimenting this year. We're going to talk about it a little bit more. It is very hard to find basils that don't get powdery mildew now. And so we've got some new varieties coming on. I'm experimenting with them this year. Classic Genovese is a great tasting basil, but it is very susceptible to disease. We're developing some new ones. If you'll go to Johnny's Select Seeds, and you have a hard time doing that, don't you? But it's going to be hard. I'm going to work on it. We're going to see. Next year, I think we're going to be ready with some basil varieties that won't get the disease problems that basil has had in the past. Does that help?
All right. I know you got to move, and thank you so much.
Yep. Have we got time for one more caller, Charlie? I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, Bill.
Who's next?
Bill, I sent that
Chris,
that picture of that quince in to you. It's growing naturally here on my property at North Pace, and I'd like to try and keep it healthy and get those things bigger. Any thoughts? Really appreciate it. Thank you, Bill.
Yeah. Quince is really easy to grow. It's probably, it was planted there years and years ago, I suspect. It's nice that it's producing fruit. I'll have to do a little bit of research to see what's the best way to manage an old clump like that. I think taking out some of the older stems might be a good idea, but I'm gonna think about this. I'm gonna talk about it with one of my friends who Martin Vandergeesen, who really loves quince, and I'm gonna come back next week because I don't have any time this week. Let's try it next week, and let's talk about that quince, okay? Thanks. Hey, good to talk to everybody. We'll be back next week.
Just walking down the road, early morning sunshine. 7 foot